Okay. So I've started recording, even though somebody just went out. Oh, yes, Alex. So this is the last class of Philosophy of Consciousness, Part 2, for those of you listening to the recording. And I'm just firing up the overheads now, hopefully. But there was something else I wanted to go through, because Nicolette said last week that my account of that there's no time in a mathematical model wasn't as clear as I thought it was. And I realised that there was a sort of a problem with the way I was describing it, so I thought I wanted to describe another little scenario, which in a way is the same, but it doesn't quite involve X's and Y's. It's not quite, I needed to start with something a bit more grounded, I think. So it's been sort of exercising me a little bit. So it's an imaginary world, because we're doing mathematics, and we're looking at this question. I was saying there's no time in physical science. You know, we were back with Metzinger, and Metzinger was saying it's very odd that there's a now, because physical time, there's no now in physical time. And I was trying to explain that him even thinking that there is physical time shows a kind of a misunderstanding on his part about what time is. So I'd just like to describe to you a little world, which isn't our world. It's a tremendously simplified version of it, which kind of recapitulates in a way what science does. So there's this little universe that comes into being. Imagine that's the Big Bang, only it's a point universe. Yeah, and the moment that the point universe comes into being, strangely enough, like in our universe, there is consciousness. Only it's the dots that have consciousness now. The dots have consciousness like us. There's a now. Suddenly you wake up, there's a now, there's a sense of time. And the first thing that happens in this universe is that there's a separation. Oh my God, it was terribly painful. A moment later, if I was to draw what's happening, say a moment later, there's still this little point. This is the, if you like, the point of the Big Bang, but I've left it. I've separated from it, and that it's like this is a terribly simple universe. There's been the Big Bang, and all was one. And suddenly, immediately, the Big Bang happened. It was like what happened was that I separated from the Big Bang and I started to move away from it. And in some extraordinary way, although I'm only a dot, I have some experience of I'm moving away from this other point which was the origin of all. Yes? And then a moment later, here I am again, and I've moved away further. I seem to be moving away at a steady rate from the dot of the origin of the universe. And I'm just experiencing this. And in fact, that's me, for, if you like, for all time. This is the entire universe at one point, then I'm a bit further away, then I'm a bit further away, then I'm a bit further away, and then I'm a bit further away, and so on and so forth. That's my experience.
Because
we're dots, I can't even say the dots getting smaller. I just feel it. I feel my separation growing from the origin. Yes, this is the most simplest universe you could imagine. At a certain point in time, I'm a strange dot. I start thinking mathematically. I think. Well, what's going on? I reflect back into the past, and I think, well, how can I describe this experience that I've had of the being a moment back there of origin, and then I get separated, 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 And all on my own, I start to invent geometry, algebra, and mathematics in an attempt to try and describe what was happening to me. At this point, we're back to the familiar graph as before. If I was to draw it, then all of these points, and try and express what's happened through time for me, I would say, well, this is my. I'm sorry, it's not a straight line as I would have hoped. This is every little point on that line is my experience of having been separate from this line. Yes. If I could concatenate all the moments, all the nows together, they become a line. And if I draw the lines like that, that expresses my becoming more and more separate from the origin. And not only that, I can start to do scientific induction and say that although I'm only here, it seems to me like it's just going to go on forever. A bit like the way we theorise about our own universe. Yes? Now, we can think of this now. I've transposed my experience into a set of coordinates, if you like, and drawn them out. And this now, you know, used to be X and Y. It's actually, I should have said this before, it's actually time. Right? This is how the universe changes as time goes on. And this up here is space. Only it's a one-dimensional spatial universe. If you have a one-dimensional spatial universe, you get dots and lines. If you get a two-dimensional spatial universe, you get surfaces. And if you get a three-dimensional spatial universe, you start getting objects like this. Now, at this point, if you take those axes and you want to describe my line, my trajectory, and the trajectory of the origin, I'm still going to call this, like before, let's say that is X and that's Y. The line that I'm drawing there, it depends how I measure time. And the way I'm measuring time is I'm going to say that I'm going to measure a certain interval of time. I don't know how I'm going to measure it because I'm a dot, right? It's going to be quite hard. But whatever I arbitrarily choose, I say for a certain amount of time, if I say time has elapsed by a unit, then I'm going to say, and space has then elapsed by a space unit. And I'm going to say, right, so we've got space units going up here, time units going along there. The mathematical description of my line, given that's how I've defined it, and because it's mathematics, and it's up to you how you define it in a way. But we might say here that it could be very arbitrary. Do you see what I mean? It's difficult to say. This is 1 year, and that's one. That's how far I travel in 1 year. And how far I travel in 1 year is one mug. I define it. How far have I travelled in 1 year? I travel one mug in 1 year. Yes? Then what we will have there is that Y equals X. In other words, for every 1X, for every 1 year, I travel one mug. Yeah? And this line now describes my trajectory in the universe. And the universe itself, it just stays at y equals zero. That's actually the zero point there, if you like. So you could say that's the trajectory of the universe, y equals zero, just carrying on and on and on and on. And here's my trajectory, y equals x, carrying on and on and on and on. Now, that's just to transpose. Really, when I was talking about X and Y last week, I meant space and time, and I forgot to mention that. Yes? And I forgot to mention that actually, in this universe, what we're tracing is a moving dot, if you like. Now, just to step out of that, if that makes a bit more sense, for the actual universe for us, there was no lines and axes or anything. I was just a dot travelling away from another dot. Yes? In a moment. I was living in this moment now. And at any particular moment, I'm having the experience of a certain feeling of distance, and that's my entire universe. And it's always now, and I've just got a feeling of a growing distance. But I've transposed all that now into this mathematical model. And there's no now there anymore. You can say, all right, I was there at point zero, right? I was there, you know, 5 mugs after point zero. But in actual fact, this model, which describes the whole universe mathematically, shows I've abstracted myself from now. There isn't any now in it anymore. And if I'm being true to what I've been saying about science, I now consider that this is a true description of the universe. My mathematical description is now a true description of what the universe is. And in fact, I now regard myself as having this kind of tiny little window onto the true universe. For some bizarre reason, I don't know why, I have a now experience where I just see little slices of what's really real. What's really real are the trajectories of these lines. What's really real, if you like, is the relationship between me and the dot of the origin. And that relationship, if we're doing the kind of science that we've been doing, which is a res extensa space-time science, the only thing that's really real is the measurableness of this. And if you look at the measurable of this and you take consciousness out, which is what science has done, there isn't any now. There's no particular point where anyone is at any moment in time. There's just this. This is just a mathematical description of the universe, and we get in some way that our mathematical science can't explain. For some reason or other, we end up moving along that line. As far as science is concerned, that's puzzling. It could equally well be that a consciousness moves that way down the line. Yes. Or it could equally be that a consciousness kind of experiences that much of the line all at once. Or it could equally be that I'm a consciousness that sees it all. That I'm infinite and I just see the infinity of the line and the infinity of I am the entire expansion all at once. You see that there's many ways that I could experience that relationship. It just so happens that I experience it as this now, 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 and I just have little slices of it. And it's, why am I moving that way? And they genuinely wonder this. It's called the arrow of time. Why am I going in that direction from zero? Why? There's nothing in the mathematical description of the universe that can explain that. You see, once again, consciousness is a kind of an extraneous puzzle. Why should there be some experience of that universe? And you now transpose that. That's just the same, a terribly simplified version of the mathematical model of our universe with the Big Bang. Only it makes more sense, our universe, because we've got physical systems that are capable of perception, whereas it's very hard to explain how a dot can perceive another dot. So I'm asking you to take a leap of imagination there. Now, the other thing about this is that the mathematics, essentially, it's in its essential purity, the universe just is that. That expresses everything there is to know about that universe, and there isn't any time in it. The sense of there being time and movement only arises when some dots in here start having an experience. And then as soon as there's a dot in a now having an experience, then that gap there starts to grow. But if you take consciousness out and you just look at the mathematics, there's nothing experiencing anything growing. In actual fact, it's completely static and finished. The entire universe is all there all at once in the mathematical description. The only way that time enters into it is if somebody ends up, in effect, making that mathematics real and into an experience.
I don't understand what you mean by, if space is y and time is x, how does y equals x and space equals zero?
No. I'm glad you're asking, but that's not saying that space and time are the same. That's just saying that the way that we chose to measure it, it turns out that they're the same. We could have measured it differently. We could have said, all right, for every step you take along here, that's one time unit. Along here, we might measure that as two space units. It's quite arbitrary.
Right.
In which case, you would have then said that...
2y is...
2y equals x. So it's, the fact that y equals x, I just chose that as the simplest expression that there could be.
Okay.
How you measure it, I didn't want to get too much into the mathematics. If you measured them in slightly different units...
and y equals zero because we're in a dot universe.
Well, that's because you just... it's quite arbitrary the way you choose your units. I could say that the universe started three time units after an imaginary point here, and then we'd fly from that point. The way that you put your coordinates is arbitrary, but the basic structure of the relationships, the mathematical relationships, remains the same. Like y equals zero just indicates that that is not moving relative to that. We could equally have done it so that we could have treated our moving away from the origin to be our staying still, and the origin moving away from us, and the equations would look different, but the basic structure of the relationship would have remained the same. So you're asking a question which is to do with mathematical invariance, which says, although these equations describing the universe can change according to the conventions that we use to measure things, the basic relationship remains the same, even though there are actually many different ways you could express it. There's an underlying mathematical invariance, which is just these two things getting further apart at a constant rate.
Doesn't that imply time?
Well, no. These things getting further apart at a constant rate is me describing it from the point of view of the dot.
Right.
If I describe it mathematically, we're just saying there's an invariant relationship where these two lines are just straight lines. They're two divergent straight lines.
Right.
It could be different. It could be that for every one, this could go up one there, and then one there, and then two there, and then four there, and then three there, and then nine there, and we could go up in an x squared relation. And that would be an experience of me accelerating away from the origin.
Right.
Yes? But it's just an x squared kind of relationship, whereas this is a simple... doesn't have a power in it, if you know a bit of maths.
But didn't the whole mathematical formula generate from your experience?
Yes, now that's exactly right. And that's how it is for our science.
Yeah.
That's almost the point, that's almost the central point of the... yes. The whole mathematical description is just a description of our experience. And if we keep that in mind, we don't end up thinking that the mathematics is the true world.
Right.
And our experience is the false world.
Don't mathematicians know that?
They do, of course they know that. when it's put like this.
Yeah.
But I have to hand it over to you. You've read Metzinger.
Mm.
Metzinger says there's no now in science.
Right. Okay.
Yes, the quote was on the board, and many scientists will say the same thing. As the more they get into the mathematics and the mathematical physics, and they immerse themselves in that world, every now and then they wake up and say, "But there's no now here." It's a subjective thing, and the subjective is not the reality. The reality is the physical. The physical is what generates our experience. Our brains are made of physical stuff. Our brains are responsible for our experience, and we shift the perspective.
Mm.
You've got to keep this in mind all the time.
Mm.
That people, as you step into the scientific world, you step out of your subjective understanding of the world, and you go into an inverted world,
right,
where everything's turned around the other way, and time becomes an insoluble puzzle.
But doesn't mean they've got the numbers wrong.
No. No, what science has done is exactly what you've said. It's given an abstract mathematical description of the structure of what we find in experience.
Mm.
But what science has then done, and what we've got, and what we've gone along with in our culture, is to say, and the world that you discover, not just because we're going behind the appearances of the senses, the world of the atoms and the molecules and the subnuclear particles and the quantum physical level, becomes the real world, because as you study it, you come to the conclusion that it's that world that's generating our experience. Because if I zap your brain, that's the end of your experience. It's just pretty basic reasoning. Yes? It's the old reasoning of the brain surgeon and the bullet and the bomb. That says, obviously, your experience is a product of the physical functioning of your brain. That comes first. Because you go to sleep each night and you die. And you, at the point of this course is to say, so at some level you go, yeah, that's right. So what's this course been about? And then I say, no, zap you out of that and say, no, do you see the whole thing was, it's like Dot University, the whole model was just a description of your experience. But we've gone so far into our instruments, delving into the underlying structure of things, that we have lost sight of the foundation or the ground of it all being our experience. We've got a different ontology. We've got an ontology that says the material is primary, and by primary I mean the deep sense of our scientific culture is that it's the stuff, the matter, that's causing everything, including your experience. And just keep what I say is keep your eyes open for this, because it's like Maria's saying, you're the scientist, and you and I in our everyday life, we don't really think that in our interactions as we're drinking coffee and having a chat. But then when anyone presents us with anything to do with a kind of a factual account of how things work here, we suddenly flip. We put our the being of our consciousness aside, and we accept a scientific understanding of things. We're kind of schizoid. So the two do not marry up. They're opposite to each other. And the other thing I'd like you to see here is in this mathematical world is that we've spatialized time. What you've done is you've taken time as we experience it and turned it into another dimension of space. And that's what relativity does. Einstein's relativity regards time as a fourth dimension, which essentially means it becomes a fourth dimension of space. It's only we can't picture it, because our ability to experience space is a three-dimensional experience. But in effect, what Einstein does and what science does is in the scientific abstraction and reflection, you create a new now. And in this new now, you now reflect back on space and time. So, do you see, if this were the real universe, we've abstracted out of the now the little dot, and we say, oh no, there's no now, there's no little dot, there's no time there. There's just these mathematical relationships. But in so doing, we're actually viewing it from another now. You can't ever get out of the now of the viewer. So that when Metzinger says there's no time in science, he's forgetting the now of the scientist who's looking at the model, and forgetting this fundamental thing. It's the tiny little message from the course is, and you were saying, Maria, it's a model. It's a model.
But I mean, when you get models, scientific models in other sciences, they often do incorporate the now. They say, for instance, you know, if the population is this size in this year, then we can project, and it was this size in that year, we can project into the future and suppose that possibly
No, there's no denial of the now. You see, it's just like here, you can say, oh yeah, no, we're, at the moment, this part of the universe, it's 15 billion years out after that. So here, this is now. You can point to now in the model, just like your sociological model, but you've still abstracted from time and made a model. And the model is not in time. The model describes time. The model has spatialized time. But that doesn't mean you can't... If you understand it's a model... Then you can go back into the model and say, oh, it's 2019, it's March the 30th, here's what's happening on 2019, March the 30th, and this is what's going to happen on March the 31st. But as far as the model's concerned, March the 30th, March the 31st, or last April, it's all the same.
Right.
Yeah? It's all just states of variables, actually.
Right.
States of measurable variables. There's no particular favouring of any now in it.
So are you saying, in terms of using models to describe the real world, for political reasons, economic reasons in the case of...
It's not wrong.
You're saying that the problem with it is that we forget where it came from.
Yes, and I think a lot of political models, sociological models, are about people and about describing human reality. And I'm talking about the uber model of our scientific culture, which is mathematical physics.
Oh, okay, I don't know if
you... No, you do. It's the uber model.
Okay.
I don't mean that you've got to be a physicist to understand it. It's the uber model because at a certain deep level... Our culture thinks that physical matter is the reality. That's what I mean, it's the uber model.
Okay.
I went to the doctor and said that the shape of my body is determined by the model of my brain. So if I change the brain, then I change how I walk, how I sit, and then my body changes.
Yes. Did you say I'm thinking about this kind of stuff in philosophy of consciousness? Because in a way we are, you know, that's part of the ego tunnel, isn't it? We don't deny that that's the case. That if you change the pattern, of what's being manifested in the brain, it'll change the pattern of the body's behaviour. But that's happening every moment as you speak. It's a pattern of activity in the brain. You can't deny that. But the point here, I'm banging on in a way that makes it sound like science isn't real in some sense, because I'm saying it ignores consciousness. But it's not binary like that. If you understand the context within which science operates, it's a model of what is measurable. And insofar as it's a model of what's measurable, it's as correct as it possibly can be. And that's its great virtue. It puts that being correct more or less first. And it's one of the very few areas of human endeavour where putting correctness first happens. Most areas of human endeavour, we put our self-interest first.
Well, our idea of what our self-interest is.
Yes. Yeah, that's right. Or we're driven by some kind of subconscious or unconscious motivation that we're not aware of, and we think we're being reasonable. But science goes to great lengths to be correct, and it's a community of people who are struggling in some way or other towards a greater and greater ideal of perfection of measurement, and it's worked.
I mean, you say that science values correctness over self-interest.
I'm saying that there's a struggle there. Everyone's concerned about their career. Everyone's concerned about getting published. Some people falsify their results. Some people distort their results. There's a whole bunch of other self-interested stuff going on in that community.
Doesn't the questions you ask determine the answers you get anyway?
Yes.
And the questions you choose to ask have their own bias.
Yes. And that's what we've been talking about. There's a deep ontological position that science has been holding for a long, long time, and that is that hasn't come from any desire to be correct. It's clearly just been inherited, and not only that, it meshes in a certain sense with the kind of economic system that we operate under. So there's self-interest at a deeper level. It's no accident that science is funded and the universities are held up as paragons, because they are the source of the technology that enables our culture to dominate the world.
I think there might be a difference between awareness of this in...
Can I just say one thing? The fact that science strives towards correctness is tolerated. That's the best I can put it. It's understood by the powers that be that you have to have a certain amount of toleration of correctness. Not too much, certainly not in the media, can't have any correctness there, but just in a special little area called the university, we realise we have to allow a certain room where people can actually strive to be correct. As long as we keep everyone more or less confused in the rest of their lives, it all works out. You imagine if we strove to be correct about our psychological situation or our political situation in the way that we strive to be correct about mathematical physics. It would be a different world. Maria, I cut you off there because I hadn't finished my...
Oh, I'm just making a note for myself. It just strikes me that, you know, when you're talking about this, it's kind of... You're talking mainly about natural sciences. Because I think with the social sciences, it's been long understood that, you know, the nature of your questions are going to determine your answers, that the consciousness of the person doing the research totally affects what they're going to find, and you need to be aware of that, and you need to be transparent about it. And then when you look at other people's research, you will have to ask questions. You're not just looking at numbers. Do you know what I mean?
Do you call that reflexivity in the social sciences, where you insert yourself into the situation?
Yeah, well, you know, I've always called it research of bias, but it might well be called reflexivity as well. But I mean, you know, when you know that describing the truth is going to be subjective, it is about your consciousness, your conscious awareness of what the truth is, and other people's conscious awareness of what they think the truth is as well. And somehow it's going to meet in the middle and maybe say something useful about a phenomenon. It's not like in natural science. There isn't this myth that somehow this science, this social science, is going to find the truth. That's a myth.
So I've got to say again that our culture is determined not by social science, but by natural science.
Right.
So randomised controlled trials, Maria, they don't, because they look at stuff that is psychological in medicine or nursing or psychology. And now they always want to try and get the randomised controlled trial where it's all, you know, randomised. It's completely unbiased. There's no person there.
They're trying randomizing, to get this,
You know, they're it's all, you know, and it's all kind of done through statistics, and there's an objective, there's quite an objective stance on it all.
See,
so there isn't one individual there kind of having a take on it.
With medical science, we're talking about science.
Psychological, not.
But I'm looking at our culture. With medical science, the science that counts is the science that produces the drugs. With physical science, the science that counts is the science that creates the chip that runs faster. Yes, that miniaturizes the electronics to the point that you can get the mobile phone. The things that determine the way we live come out of science that actually makes discoveries. Now, what are the discoveries, I don't want to say this too harshly, of social science that have transformed the way we live, that everybody accepts? See, it seems to me that when you move out, when the boundary where we move from natural science to social science is where we move from a coordinated intersecting activity that actually stands on the shoulders of giants, etc., all of that. But from Newton to now, there's been a tremendous progress in terms of our ability to predict what happens in the res extensa. What's happened in psychology and social sciences is the uprising of certain schools of thought and their demise. Now, there's a vague sense, I've studied philosophy for a while, there's a vague sense that there is a kind of inching kind of progress, that the models that and the schools of thought that were rejected in the past aren't going to ever come back in the form that they were in the past, but they do tend to come back in a revised form. What goes around comes around. The Labour Party. Look at the Labour Party. The Labour Party, what goes around comes around, right? I was there in the 70s, Michael Foot, Tony Benn. Right, Michael Foot and Tony Benn have sort of come around, but they're not the same. Yeah, there's a vague sense that there's a sort of a spiral, if we're optimistic, that somehow a little bit has been learned from experience. But it doesn't... There's a deep division, because the scientific method just hasn't worked in the study of human social relations.
There is a bigger understanding of it than there was 30 years ago.
Yes.
People are putting people's psychological well-being is more important.
Yes.
In the care of the sick. Or the care of the mentally ill.
But that's a change of attitude, right, isn't it? A change of
training,
yes.
People's training. It's given a lot more high priority than it used to be.
But I'm spinning off here, but the sense I have is that we've been through two world
studies as well.
It's not through studies, I don't think it's through studies. I think it's through two world wars. It's through the attempt of after the Second World War to introduce socialism, the kind of the dawning realization that if you're sexually abused and traumatized, it's not a good thing. You shouldn't just shut up and forget about it. These are you don't have to do research to discover that.
No,
it's like you're talking to somebody who's extremely dim, but then it takes decades for them to realise what hurts. I'm feeling I'm almost getting on a.
I think when you say you're talking about affecting changes. I mean, the thing about technology is that we can see those changes, yeah? But I mean, social science, for a long time, I'll give you an example. I worked with an organisation called Women's Aid, which was to do with, women who've been subjected to domestic abuse. And I was working in the Midlands, and I belonged to a pressure group that was trying to put pressure on the council to provide a refuge. And the position of the council was absolutely, this does not happen in our town. There is no domestic abuse in our town. We're not that sort of person. It does not go on. So what we did was we started a phone line and we collected, just numbers, evidence of how many people we were getting phone calls from and how we'd had to find refuges from them in outlying areas, blah, blah, blah. And then we came back to the council and said, and they went, and gave us a refuge. So it's a small change,
What did you discover? Do you know, I'm talking about science makes discoveries, and you get a piece of knowledge that you didn't have.
Councils tend to want to ignore.
Yeah, but look at it, Maria. That's not science, is it? I mean, any. It's just a. Gathering evidence is just you have to go through that process. Because the only thing that has any respect here is gathering evidence, because we're a scientifically based culture. Basically, what you discovered was what any intelligent person could have told you just by using their eyes. I mean, I don't like to describe all of social science and psychology in that manner, but you're not discovering any amazing new knowledge. You're having to painstakingly find evidence to express the bleeding obvious. Usually.
It wasn't bleeding obvious to them, though, was it?
It was obvious, though, wasn't it? The situation that you're using evidence and the covering of being objective and scientific, because that's the only way that anyone will listen to you. But in fact, what you're really doing is pointing out what anyone with a reasonably clear and sensitive awareness would be able to see for themselves. Do you see how different that is to finding out that you can focus light of a certain wavelength and get it and produce a laser? Nobody knew that. I'm just, because you've got a natural science and there's social science, as if there is this other science.
Yeah, but your question was, what has it changed? So I thought of an example.
Yes, and I'm coming back at you and saying, you were using the trappings or the appearance of science to try and persuade a power-possessing body that it wasn't aware of what was going on under its nose. And I'm saying, well, that's not, for me... social science, let me put it another way, social science, if it were like physics, would understand our society univocally. Not there'd be 17 different schools of opinion about how our society functions. There would be an objective understanding of how society works. There would be an objective understanding of human psychology. There would be an objective understanding of what makes people depressed. There would be an objective understanding of how to cure mental illness that isn't just a chemical imbalance. There would be an objective understanding that would reach to the point where the kind of social conflicts that we are engaged in, which are so obviously stupid, they'd be all over, because we'd understand, if you like, how it all works. And as soon as you understand how it all works, you can then fix it. We don't understand how it all works. We can't fix it. We don't understand human psychology. Now, except maybe a few individuals have an understanding of human psychology.
And these bodies that like change society and pass laws and legislations and policies, these bodies are a combination of lobbying, donations, buying gifts, bribing, private kind of interests, special kind of...
But I
this is a combination of that, not the objective understanding of
society. Do you get the picture of what, if social science were like mathematical physics...
I don't think it can be.
No, there are probably very good reasons why... But I think that there's a possibility of an enlightened civilization a long way in our future, where we could say that, oh yes, there is social science now, and social science in a way that instead of trying to fix the most stupid conflicts that just recur and recur and recur, we actually engineer a civilization that is the most creative and fulfilling civilization that the world has ever seen, and it's even more creative and more fulfilling than it was 10 years ago because we understand how it works. Now, at the moment, we don't have such a social science. We have something that's sort of hobbling along behind physical science, trying to use the methods of physical science, and then saying, well, they don't work. We better try and find some other way to do it. We better take the observer into account. But we haven't... it hasn't coalesced, that's the word I want to use, so that everybody working within that field understands what they're doing and knows the way forward. And physical science, within its domain, has done that, and that's why it's determined our culture. Because it's the only thing that we've been successful with. Mathematical science is the only thing that we've been any good at. That's a harsh generalisation. I'm going to say that other things have occurred, but not because of doing science. Other things have occurred because through our own suffering, we've recognised sort of elementary things like women are human beings too. Do you know? That wasn't a scientific discovery. That was some. Do you know what? Our culture has. It hasn't been absolutely static. It's got better than it was in certain domains, but not as a result of people at university studying things. I don't think. It's tremendous lessons like the Second World War that have actually changed things for us.
And the suffragettes.
The suffragettes. The actual movements of people forcing the
suffragette, they just appeared. If you read history, it appears as if the suffragettes made change, but it's not really. The whole world started to realize after the Industrial Revolution that if you want to become a nation, if you want to become a state, if you want to compete with other states, you have to get the women out of their houses, send them to work. All the nations done that. You want Britain to be the only country in the world not to get the women out of houses and put them to work? Of course, it is part of the plan to come up with a nation that is modern, a modern nation.
But I think it would be a mistake to say that somebody sat down and planned that. It wasn't planned. It came about.
But like this idea that the suffragette done it, that's just not really true.
No, but the suffragette movement was an expression.
It's an artistic expression, okay.
I wouldn't say artistic, but over to the women on this. You know, it's not as simple as it's, there's no one view that's why social science is in a way doomed. Because there isn't any one view that's correct when it comes to the human beings. There's that aspect, right? If there wasn't
Turkey, the Islamic country,
yeah,
Atatürk was getting the women out to work, and he was like ban veiling. You want Britain not to get the women out?
Yeah, but the reason that
Atatürk is the biggest patriarch.
Yes,
the biggest patriarch, such a patriarchal man, brutal man. He wanted to women to work, and because he realized if he wants.
Yes,
to
but did he want the women to vote and be members of parliament?
Exactly, because he wanted Turkey to compete with Western powers. So if Turkey got the women out, you want Britain, the civilized,
yeah, but
Christian nation.
Before we're going to close this down, but the suffragette movement was a. Because my limited experience of the Middle East is that hasn't arrived there yet. The sense that there actually is some genuine equality between men and women, and that's come out of the West. That's one of the great.
Of course, the model was to imitate the West.
Yes.
Attitude.
But this idea that there's equality between
Stalin got the women out.
Yeah, but it wasn't.
Can I say something?
Yes. Yes.
As I understand, one of the sort of kind of feminists and I'm not even going to go into that. Women working shouldn't be necessarily the marker that we use for equality. Some people would say recognising motherhood as equal to work is also a form of equality.
I was
ability to work means that they're somehow equal.
Well, this is
I wouldn't necessarily agree.
It's a deeper thing than that. It's a much deeper thing than going out to work.
Yeah.
You know, it's a much deeper thing.
Stalin knew that people
being,
thing, right?
Being able to just
bloody vote, Stalin was an ardent supporter of, he was such an extremist person who wanted the women to go out, to break away from the traditionalist Russian family. Embracing modern vote and go to work. Stalin wanted that to happen. If Stalin, this brutal man, brought about this idea before Britain. You want Britain not to do it? It's a competition.
Don't you think that if we're looking at the difference between, you know, the fact that social science can't explain phenomena or predict phenomena, the reason for that is because the phenomena that they're dealing with are completely different to the phenomena of somebody who's trying to work out what, you know, the hardness of this table or, you know, how the stress-breaking point of this pen. Because the nature of the concepts that are used. I mean, we're talking about equality here. There are lots of different definitions of what that actually is. And I think that one of the differences between social and natural science is that there's, in natural science, there's often agreement on what oxygen is or what, you know, there's agreement.
It's not about equality. It's about getting everybody to operate in the institutions of the country.
I'm just giving it as an
example.
I'm not arguing with you. I'm just giving it as an example of a concept.
Yeah.
A concept like the concepts that are used in social science are completely, you know, they're completely biased and subjective, and you need to be able to reveal what you mean by that. Whereas in a way that a natural scientist, doesn't have to reveal what they mean by, you know, I don't know, mercury or whatever.
So can I bring it back? Because we're wrapping this all together. The reason that physical science has been successful and social science has been disorganised, it's all part of what we've been looking at in this course.
Mm.
It's all part of that separation with at the early part of science, where the res extensa was considered to be what's ultimately real.
Mm.
And so the social sciences are themselves crippled by that background. In order for social science and psychology to become coherent, you need a coherent ontology.
Yeah.
a coherent idea of what it is to be a human being. We don't have a coherent idea of what it is to be a human being. So how can we have coherent psychology and coherent social science when our very notion of what the being of being is, what it is to be conscious, is a kind of an inexplicability for our scientific outlook. And in a way, phenomenology isn't one of the aspects of phenomenology for me. Is it's a beginning getting behind science to a place where you can start to make sense. Because you can only start to make sense of human experience, I think, when you recognise that it is the source out of which everything else arises. And that's almost a heresy these days. There are people who consider that anthropocentric to think that it's a kind of being cruel to animals, like you're being sexist. To distinguish yourself from an animal now is soon going to be a wrong thing, you know. But what right have we to do that? Now I'm going to start the lecture now. That was just a digression, where I hope you could see that the mathematics abstracts from experience, and in abstracting from experience, you abstract from space and time, and you just end up with variable quantities. And the variable quantities become space and time only when we. I always get the picture. It's like we take the mathematics and. We project it into space and time. Now, when we do science, that's what the scientist does. The scientist doesn't recognise that the mathematics has no space and time, because as soon as you try and understand the maths, the kind of brains we have immediately say, "Ah, I'll draw a graph." You project it back into space and time, because if you don't do that, you've got nothing. You know, if you take space and time away from us creatures. Unless you're, I think in some sense there are mystical states that people report that there is some kind of something behind space and time. But for us, it's unthinkable. Anyway, we're at part two of the culmination of our course, and I'd like to settle us back into Heidegger and forget some of the controversial things I was saying about social science, of which I'm not a social scientist and I have no real remit for that. I did want to say, I mean, thank God you don't have those awful comedians anymore. I'm thinking about how things have progressed. Some of you weren't there in the 1970s. You know, there was a continuous sense of denigration of women on television all the time.
Bernard Manning.
He's one, but even if you look at Monty Python, you know the women come on, you know they're all da 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 da, you know, all of them were either you denigrated or portrayed as flouncy kind of non-entities. You know, it was just terrible, and so the sense that we haven't progressed, we've progressed in certain domains tremendously. So it's not all nothing.
And that was only 30 years ago.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. And my dad, you know, my dad, he'd probably be put in jail now. But Jesus. You know, he just made an art of putting my mum down, you know. That was one of his jobs, to kind of assert his own kind of how stupid she was and how clever he was all the time, you know. Oh, God. I look back on it and I think, what a debilitating... I've just been looking at it, you know, because I'm in analysis. What a debilitating world to have been brought into, you know, psychologically. And this is only yesterday, in terms of, you know, human time. So we mustn't ignore that. But I don't think that that change occurred because of people at university doing social science. You know, it's tolerated all that stuff at university because the people in power, I think, understand it doesn't really do anything. Keeps a few people in work and gives people the sense that maybe something's being done.
Is that the same for philosophy then?
Exactly. Well, that's what That's what last week's class in a way was saying, you know, it's the end of philosophy, right? Philosophy has no real force anymore in the world. It's all being determined by, you know, what Apple are going to do next. That's our philosophy now, isn't it? What's the next turn we're going to take on social media? What's going to replace social media? That's good.
They're not in far eastern countries, they're in far away places.
Not yet.
Or do you think Apple's...
Yeah, well, I mean, everyone's got a mobile phone now, haven't they?
Yeah.
Even monks.
Even monks. Got a mobile phone. In Africa, yeah. People, you know, people who have no money and are trying to go and get health.
And water.
Have a mobile phone. They have a mobile phone and they might be walking miles to go to the hospital to get treatment for their child but they've still got a mobile phone.
Yeah. I think it's the people in the Amazon will start using
phones. So, because I think somebody somewhere in the early part of the course said technology is neutral. But no human committee said, oh, I think that... let's totally transform the way that people communicate with each other and the way that they live and the way that they spend their time.
I think in the future, other apes as well are going to start using mobile phones.
It's designed for that level of intelligence, isn't it? It's
they can use chimps, can't they?
Yeah. That's when I first saw the iPad. I thought, but so it's just for a 3-year-old, is it? It did, and it is, I think. It's about... yeah, nothing too challenging. Some of you got fingers, and you can just gaze at things. All right.
I don't think dogs can use them.
Yeah, but if they could get treats from doing special things on poor operated devices, I think they'd soon pick up them. On how to work it, you know. So it's going to be we're in a different atmosphere entirely to Heidegger and where he is. Let's see if we can just ease our way, maybe just back into the atmosphere of Heidegger. He wants to talk about the task reserved for thinking, and this is quite. You know, we were talking last week about the end of philosophy. Its task in a way was to produce this scientific culture, and now we have this scientific culture, it's the sciences themselves that, if you like, determine for us what's real and what isn't. So the thinking in question here, and we don't, it's the usual Heidegger. We don't know what the thinking in question here is. Do you know we're moving in a circle? In a way, he's trying to indicate something. This is classic Heidegger. He's trying to indicate something that he can't say directly. So we're starting to move in this circle around. Heidegger wants to say, so philosophy's over, is it? But is there a task reserved for thinking? Is there something unthought in all of this? That in a way he's almost saying something to come, but something that's... And he in his What Calls for Thinking, that lecture series, he talks almost that there's something calling us, and he's talking about that there's the thinking in question. What is this? At this part of the essay, he's kind of dealing with the fact that maybe what he's saying sounds a bit arrogant. Because he's saying that, in some sense, what he's saying here is above and beyond philosophy. And he's saying, no, it's not. It's not above and beyond philosophy. It's less than philosophy. Not only that, the sort of thing that he's doing is going to have less effect than philosophy ever had in the past. Because, and for him, the media wasn't quite what the media is today, but... It's the media now that determines what people think, not books written by learned philosophers. He's sort of saying this. What someone like Heidegger has to say is only going to reach a very few people. Because this is what he's saying. He's saying that we are formed by technology and science. And that one of the things I think I'd like to have got through in this course is what that means. Because it's not at all obvious when you pick up the sun, right, that it's there's any technology or science in it at all. But it's concealed in the way that we operate. And he's talking about a preparatory kind of thinking. A thinking for me, I often, with Heidegger, I in some sense almost wanted to use another word, not thinking. But I don't know what that word is. Pondering, contemplating. It's a kind of a... the piece I wrote earlier in the other course, a kind of a looking and seeing. It's not as if thinking has a kind of a, for me, a sense that I'm doing it. Whereas the sort of thinking that Heidegger's talking about is more of a receiving. You know, that you're a receiving, or you're almost attuning yourself to something that you're picking up. Whereas he is always contrast that to a calculative thinking that has something in mind, that's trying to work something out. And for me, or it's daydreaming, or it's going into its memory. For me, thinking is all of that stuff. And what Heidegger means by thinking is a kind of an attunement. It's not exactly passive, because you have to be actively attuned. But you're at the same time, you're listening for something. So it's not got the... Maybe we need another word. You know, a great philosopher may think...
Allocution.
Well, that's...
The uncovering.
Yes. Well, and do you know if it is pronounced aletheia? Or aletheia? Somebody pronounced... I always pronounce
Althea.
It
I think it's Althea, A-L-T-H-E-A, no?
Yes, but it's Greek, it's a Greek word. Yes.
I would say Althea.
I'm going to go, because I call it Aletheia, and somebody who knew the pronunciation once pronounced it, and I thought, oh, that's not how I pronounce it, and then I immediately forgot the correct pronunciation. So I just know that I say it wrong. But it's quite deep in me now. I call it Aletheia because I do. So it's like Paris being Paris. If you could just live with my pronunciation, bearing in mind that it's a kind of anglicised version of another word. But yes, Aletheia is has an aspect of this, but it's still not the. I still don't think it's the right word.
Americans, I think they say Elysia.
Do they?
Does it mean happiness?
No.
Happiness.
Uncovering.
What does it mean?
It means when you trot off into the forest and you come across a little glade, and it's in which the light is shining and things are revealed to you. That's what I think it says.
But I guess maybe you might not have picked up on this, although it is mentioned, that... Aletheia, let's call it Aletheia, in Greek is means truth now. It's come to mean truth. And it was translated into Latin as veritas, you know, verity, truth. So Heidegger's...
truth by revelation, I
think. Heidegger's understanding of the word meaning unconcealedness goes back to the roots of the Greek word, but it's not how the Greeks actually used the word. He's making quite a radical claim that this is the true meaning of aletheia, because it's come to mean truth in the sense that we mean it. Truth is correctness, that something's true because, I mean, in philosophy for us, it's come to be a kind of a correspondence between something you think or say and the way things actually are. It's a kind of correspondence. Say, I've got a correct... I have a true representation of how things really are. And aletheia is not that. in Heidegger's understanding, although he's moved, because for a long time he was translating Aletheia's truth in his earlier writings, and he's actually moved to a different understanding of it here. So it's quite fluid. He's trying to use the word Aletheia a bit like Plato used the word idea.
Yeah.
You know, idea in Greek in Plato's time just meant the way things show themselves.
Part of happiness in heaven is the ability to see God, which is the truth.
Yes.
And that's the utmost kind of happiness.
Yes.
And when you realize that something is, when you reach the truth, you feel happy.
Yes.
And
that's what Maria was saying. The truth is revelation. There's a revelation in it. But truth for us has become what's called adequation. There's an adequation between what you think and how things are, and it's lost any sense of revelation anymore. It's more like, it's our materialistic sense that there's the material universe out there, it's all fixed, that's the real reality, and our job is to have a correct idea of it. And if we have a correct idea of it, then that's the truth. Truth is correctness, as it's called. Truth is revelation, is getting closer to a former understanding of truth that we've slipped away from. And the revelation then falls back into Aletheia, as you were saying, which is the revelation is the unconcealing of what was concealed. And there is that sense that when you see a deep truth, that something is revealed to you that was concealed before, especially in your life, where you've held something, an idea, and it's false. In some sense, when you see that it's false, it's almost instantaneous. You just suddenly, the covering is off. My God, I believe that. And you, almost in an instant, you see how that belief coloured all of these other aspects of your life. And then you suddenly, you're free, and it's like, yes. But that's, you know, scientific truth isn't like that. It's either it's 7 meters long or it's 8 meters long. You know, there's no real revelation in that. That's just something is correct. So he's talking about something, and he wants us to be like and join him, right? The awakening, a readiness for a possibility whose contour remains obscure, whose coming remains uncertain. You see, this is where Heidegger starts to being accused of being a mystic and a poet. Yes, because he's almost trying to, and in the language that he's, the way he's using Aletheia, he's trying to make it a poetic term. And in a way, he's almost accepting that by saying, well, this is the end of philosophy, but there's a task left. Maybe we won't call it philosophy. Maybe we'll call it something else. I don't know, because the contour is obscure. But there's something, and it's something to do with philosophy, because jumping ahead, because he has a sense that it was there at the beginning in the ancient Greeks. And he thinks it's been reserved in a certain way for us. And then he's got a little bit of, you know, the air of how he sees things, yes? He's seeing that this technological, scientific, industrial character of our civilization is becoming the sole criterion of our world sojourn. Another lovely word, in a sense, we're having a sojourn here on Earth. I sometimes feel it that way. If you're extremely concerned about the state of the planet, I find it quite settling to treat my life as a sojourn. I'm just down here, in some sense, in this period of history.
Settler.
It's a sojourn. It's quite an interesting period as well, I think, if you look across history. Sojourn almost implies to me a certain feeling that I've come just to appreciate it, even in all its chaoticness, you know, even in all its uncertainty. even in all the destruction of the species, everything that's happening, the sojourn is, but I'm just here as a way, you know, I'm just here to see it. That's my fundamental task, is to see it. As opposed to fixing it. Yes, yes. Because there is that, I think we all have a sense of that as well, you know. When you really look into what's going on, there's an impulse to try and fix it. All I can say is you should never try and fix something you don't understand. Understand it first. And then that way you never do anything, because it's... So he's talking about the destiny of man. We're still in the time when that just is man and woman. Well, you know, she's in the kitchen. There's a sense of it, isn't there, in the language?
I didn't pick
that up. Didn't you?
No.
I have a sensitivity to the destiny of humanity. Why didn't you say humanity?
Man in those days meant.
Yes. Exactly.
Even in the Bible,
yes.
It says, man.
But
God supremes.
Yeah. over the decades, I've started to find it. It's just there was an assumption in it that the only people who are reading this are other men, and it's the men who are making decisions.
Yeah.
And, you know, of course we mean woman, but she's hardly worth mentioning. Whereas now it sort of stands out as we're in it together, you know. I mean,
yes.
I feel like digressing to the point of saying, because he's talking about the destiny of man as if there is no woman involved in it, and that's, you know, actually the that is in one way expresses the entire error of our civilization.
No gender in Dasein, is there?
No, Dasein, I don't mind a neutral word.
No, it's
yeah.
Not
the
same.
Yeah. Well, you remember we caught him another day? That he was saying something like, you know, that somebody in the lecture theatre might even be understanding me, and it might even be a woman.
Yeah.
Do you know, as if that was an extraordinary... Do you know the... It's like there was a anti-Semitism in the culture of Germany before the war, that before Hitler, right? And here, which was just kind of, it was a bit like this, just it's just in the culture. Yeah.
When was this written, John?
This is 64, wasn't it?
Yeah.
And it's just as uncertain whether world civilization will soon be abruptly destroyed or whether it will be stabilized for a long time. However, you know, such stabilization won't be any sort of enduringness. It will be a sequence of changes, each presenting the latest novelty. Well, not a bad prophecy. It's as in it has. We're still there. It's stabilized itself a bit more than it had in 64. Because the Soviet Union collapsed, even though the Soviet Union was hardly a dramatic alternative to Western capitalism, it was just a different form of technological industrial society. Vader's novelty is still what we experience, continuous change, and we still have the sense that it might end any moment. So the kind of stabilisation we have is a stabilisation in the midst of continuous change. It's a strange state of civilisation. But again, Heidegger, I find him quite settling, because you can almost feel like he doesn't really care whether it collapses or whether it goes on, you know, because he's coming from a place saying it's all in the balance, this destiny. He's sort of trying to see through, yes.
At the end, he was a little influenced for thinking.
Yes, I mean that I haven't followed this up, but there are people who think that he was he'd never admit to being influenced by Eastern thinking, but there's a certain parallelism. His perspective became more harmonious with an Eastern perspective, and I think there are people in Zen Buddhism who find Heidegger has something to say to them.
I mean, the amount of destruction in those days, he witnessed the kind of destruction that was biblical.
Yes, of course, of course. That's right. That's what I think. Every now and then I get a bit too caught. I mean, Brexit. You just got to remember, No Deal Brexit. It's not the invasion of Poland. As an event.
They're saying on the radio that they're
going to
get together a sort of warlike committee.
Yes, but
they're using this.
In the Second World War, the U-boats were sinking, ships faster than they could be built. And there was still 60 million people here and virtually no supplies, and amazingly, we got through. And Brexit's being built up like it's going to be an equivalent catastrophe, because it's going to take a little bit of time at the border to work out what the customs duty is. I'm not saying I support Brexit. I just mean the whole way that it's being built up is.
Maybe they're trying to drum up a sort of warlike spirit.
Into people by
saying
Dunkirk spirit.
Yes, basically.
Yeah.
I mean, I just wander into the co-op every now and then and just cast my eye over the Daily Mail, I can only bear it for a moment or two. But yesterday was this proud sovereign nation. We were going to become the proud sovereign nation again. It's all been snatched from us by those Europeans, we'll be flying the Spitfires again, boys. Don't worry.
So is it like you're gonna fight with the EU army?
They do.
They're
all standing
up. Like saying that the EU is gonna form an army, so. Britain is going to fight with this army?
No, let's go back to Jung. I mean, there's something going on here where I haven't quite broken free of mummy and daddy yet, But maybe if I leave the EU, I can be a real person again. I think there's something infantile in it. Anyway, let's not go there. So what remains unthought in the matter of philosophy as well as in its method? Now, there's a big block that I haven't covered here, which he was talking about Hegel's speculative dialectic. Because if you've done the reading, he was interested in this getting back to the matter itself. And both Hegel and Husserl were... spoke at length about getting back to the matter itself, which in some sense means getting back to experience, to consciousness, to how things actually are, not how we think they are, or through some theory or through some scientific understanding that we encounter what is directly. And phenomenology, of course, we've looked at that. That's one approach, but we haven't looked at Hegel's dialectic. But Hegel was an idealist as well. It's like Nietzsche. I'm not a Hegel scholar, but Kant had this idea that space and time are modes of representing the world, but that there is a thing in itself. Behind that our consciousness, if you like, presents, and Hegel, I think, his step further on was to say, well, what is this thing in itself? If it wasn't there, we wouldn't notice. Yeah. The thing in itself, all we ever know is our representation of the being of the world, So Hegel took the step further and said, well, it's all subjectivity. It's absolute subjectivity. And the speculative dialectic was his exploration of absolute subjectivity, which, as you may know, he did a whole interpretation of the evolution of consciousness being a play of opposites. And whenever something emerges that's partial here, whenever a partial idea emerges here, its opposite necessarily emerges to oppose it, and then the speculative dialectic, the evolution of consciousness, is then to see how the one side and the other is synthesized into a higher idea that then produces its opposite that's synthesized. And in this Hegelian ascent, you finally reach to the absolute, where there is no more synthesis, there's no more division, there's no more duality. It's a kind of a intellectual non-dualism that Hegel arrives at. But what Heidegger wants to say here is that, but what is the space within which Hegel was thinking? He's saying something, I think, essentially very simple here, which is that whatever we do, what philosophy has been doing from the get-go, is it's been thinking, representing, and even Husserl was looking at the immediacy of experience. We're always, in everyday life, we're always looking at something. And Heidegger's interest from Being and Time onwards is in some way to say, all right, you're always looking at something, but what is this space in which the something that you're looking at is appearing? You can call it the background, but the background doesn't say it quite right either. He's saying the unthought in philosophy is you've been thinking and thinking about what's appearing, but not about the appearance itself, the appearing itself. What is the appearing? Stuff appears, and we all study that. Even now, my words are appearing, and that's the subject of your attention, is what my words might mean. But now, in my words, and with Heidegger, I'm trying to say, but look, I don't know what word to use. He wants to call it the clearing. If you've done the reading, there's an openness within which everything that is appears, and you can't pay attention to it. You can't single it out, because as soon as you single it out, you lose it. And yet, in some sense, you can approach it. This is the task of thinking, to try and approach. Heidegger's original question was, what is being? And he's now looking at being in the sense that all being, only the only being we know is what appears. And he's looking into the appearing of what appears, and in some sense trying to get a sense of something that's tremendously elusive, and yet it's not elusive because it's always present to us. It's not present like the phone. It's where everything present appears. and it's not a place, because there's a doing. The appearing is just continuously occurring. It's not like an empty vessel where stuff enters and leaves. It's there's an activity going on here, an activity of what he calls an uncovering or an unconcealing. See, we've got this. I knew I'd start leaving the slides behind. We've got this sense deep in us of there being the ongoing reality of the material world. That's the reality. And in a sense, when we open our eyes, we're looking at the material world, which is this ongoing thing that is has the real being. And Heidegger's now wants to talk about, no, where we are is the place where everything that is appears. That's the real place. We don't open our eyes and see the world in the way that we have the feeling that we do. We are, each one of us is actually the very centre of the appearance of the world, and there isn't what the world is aside from its appearing to us is hidden. All that we ever, what's actually happening is that the world is appearing all the time, every moment, appearing, and the way that it appears is entirely dependent on us, each one of us. But that's, we're not like Metzinger's thinking, hallucinating it either. We're this it's this extraordinary place where it's almost like the because you know he's talking about the clearing of being. I'm getting ahead of it, but he wants to describe this as a clearing in the forest. That's his analogy. So he pictures a dense forest, and if you like, the dense forest is everything that's hidden. And there's a clearing in the forest where the trees have been thinned and light can get in and things are able to show themselves. And that's what he wants to describe. But he doesn't want to call it your consciousness or your subjectivity, because it's not a personal possession of yours. Because you're not, it's an actual place where being is made present, and it's not by saying it's not subjective. What Heidegger is indicating is that other beings show themselves in the clearing. It's not you're not hallucinating or imagining it. Other beings show themselves in the clearing. And if there were no clearing, then no being would be able to show itself. You see, if I can just jump, we have a kind of a model where we think that beings, it's the old philosophical thing that all the stuff of the universe is showing itself when we're not there. And Heidegger's saying, no. You see, without... And he won't use the word consciousness. Without Dasein, and we aren't thinking about the animals now, the animals obviously have some kind of clearing as well, but not quite the same as the kind of clearing that we inhabit. But it's not a personal clearing. It's not like you have a clearing. It's like the structure of the clearing is the same for all of us. You might be the one who seems to be the subject, and I might be appearing to you, and I might be the one who seems to be the subject, and you might be appearing to me, but the clearing is the clearing. Do you see? And there's a certain sense here where you can't be logical in that sense of saying, well, are there 7 billion clearings on Earth or just one? And the answer is, well, yes, they're both true. Do you see, you can't grasp it that way. He's trying to indicate something that's ungraspable in that sense, because you're trying to treat the clearing as if it were an object. And it's not. It's a sheer... we don't have a language for it. Do you see, every language is always about talking about what's appearing in the clearing. We don't have any language to talk about the clearing, except insofar as we start to try and develop some kind of poetic sense of trying to indicate the meaning of it.
So he's only talking about things like the table, the cup and so forth. He's not talking about like something that appears like an idea or...
No.
Feeling.
No, he's talking about that too. He's talking about...
Everything.
So, just because he's talking about Hegel's speculative dialectic in this slide, where does that appear? Where do you have all your ideas? He's talking about all being, the being of ideas, the being of your own sense of your attunements, how you're feeling, everything that you might call your inner life and everything that you might call your outer life, it's all in the clearing. No clearing, no unconcealing, no experience. So everything that... Because he's talking about the clearing allows the light to play, and we understand in a way that we have a certain light of attention.
So if I'm in denial of my grief.
Yes.
Then the grief is not in the clearing.
Well, the grief is, I mean, it's a good model of the psyche. The grief is hidden.
Yeah, it's hidden.
It's kind of it's hard to say whether it's the clearing is pregnant with the grief in a certain way, isn't it?
Mm.
It's remaining concealed, but it's not completely concealed.
No.
Do you know it's got that sense that the clearing has all of these margins of concealment and the different, almost different degrees of concealment. And there's the table or the chair is in the bright light, if you like, of unconcealment. But at the same time, I think he's a phenomenologist like Husserl. And he'd say, but the back of the chair is concealed. Everywhere, there's concealment everywhere. There's a whole interplay in the clearing of concealment. What's behind me is concealed, but as I turn around, I open it up. If you get attuned to it, it's just fascinating. That wherever you look, you can open it up. It's like the horizons that Husserl was talking about. We've got all of these sensory horizons, but not just that. We can open up memory. Yeah, we live in this place with all of these horizons around the clearing, and we can just keep. We can turn our wherever we turn our attention, the clearing opens. And he's trying to describe what kind of being we are. The idea we have is that we're a kind of a camera. Yeah, there's just the world out there, and we open our eyes, and there's a film, and we just develop the film, and it's all there just as we see it, whether we see it or not. And Heidegger's saying, no, that's not the kind of being we are. There's nothing is distinguished from anything else until there's a clearing within which it can be distinguished. All the stuff, what we think of as the universe is all undistinguished. It's just all together, if you like. Like the dark, dense forest, where everything's just forest. There's no individual trees there until you look around and the clearing opens and you say, ah, there's a tree. The tree appeared because of your act of distinction. And it's not that it wasn't there before, but it wasn't distinguished. So it didn't have being in the way that it's, you know, it's only in the clearing that being is. Well, the denial's a kind of a negation, so there's a kind of a positive experience of denial, but you know,
it's still there in the clearing.
Yes, but if there's a denial in the clearing, then the grief is sort of there, because the denial knows what it's denying, doesn't it?
Yeah, it's behind it.
Do you know that the denial always has a kind of signature of what it's denying? Do you see how? It's not poetic in that he's making it up. He's attempting to describe Dasein, our being, what it's really like, and that we've got a kind of a model of it, a spatio-temporal, heavily influenced by science model of what our experience is. And we miss the moment-to-moment kind of miracle that is the appearance of everything that appears to us. And I mean, a lot of the time we miss that because we're sort of abstracted into thinking about what's appeared, which is even a second level of removal, but you can't stop it. You can't stop it. Your thinking is appearing. It's all this is a recognition of the appearing.
So in what he's saying, then it follows that if there is, let's say, a star that no one has ever seen at all, then it's never been in any clearing, and in some ways it doesn't exist. Even though it might exist physically, it doesn't exist in consciousness.
So these are all words that Heidegger's gone to great lengths to avoid, and because in a way you're translating back what he's saying back into a subjective, objective, physical framework.
Well, what else can I do? Sorry, that's I'm trying to make sense of the damn stuff, you know.
But no, that's the point. If you make sense of it like that, it collapses.
Well, it doesn't. It doesn't collapse at all. It makes perfect sense. It's like saying things don't.
I can quote you about the star. I'll quote Heidegger to you rather than me. He said something along the lines of, not about the star, but if we're talking about the star, without Dasein, one can't say that the star exists, but equally one can't say it doesn't exist.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, I get that. But things are not created for us. Really?
Well, I think Heidegger has a sense that there's a power that holds sway in the clearing that grants the unconcealment.
Well, when I say for us, I mean, because there was that famous, I can't remember his name now, but there was this famous ornithologist that went over to New Guinea and saw all those fantastic birds of paradise, and he said that they're just stunningly beautiful. But they weren't created for us, they were created for each other. That all that splendour is not for human beings, it's not for the benefit of human beings, it's for the benefit of the birds. Because until I come along and had went and found these very difficult to find birds, you know, their displays and their splendour was not for us. And he had a real sense of that. And so, you know, I mean,
so the thing we have to say from all of our studies is that the recognition of the splendor of the color of the birds required Dasein. The birds aren't having that. If we're following everything about how it is for the animals, the colors are there for the animals, but they're not experienced as being splendid.
No, but their experience is sexually exciting.
Yes.
Which we don't get. Or
yes.
We probably
yeah.
don't
but,
get.
But you see, our appreciation of the splendour and the beauty of the colours is what we bring. And he would be wrong there to say that it wasn't created for us. It's like, again, it wasn't created for us, but it wasn't not created for us either. And if I can borrow from Jung, I mean, Carl Jung's final view on this was that that's what we're here for. We're here to see the splendour of the colours of the birds, not for the birds, but for, in some sense, on behalf of the whole universe. Well, no, because that's what we do, right? That's what we bring. That's what the Dasein, the clearing.
But if no human being had ever seen a particular bird and it was extinct now, and it had been the most splendiferous thing imaginable, right? But no human had ever seen it.
But
it wouldn't have been a waste, would it?
But if nobody had seen it
yeah.
and experienced it as being splendid, in some sense. Then it wouldn't have been splendid, would it? It would have just been.
Well, it'd been marvellous to other birds at the time.
But do you see, birds don't marvel.
Oh, they're like really quite entranced by things.
Yes, that's the word, isn't it? We're being Heideggerian here. Of course, they're entranced. Yes, that's right. But they don't marvel. Marvel is an appreciation of being. The idea, I guess, for Heidegger here and for me is that we marvel at the clearing. We marvel at what it is, at what's granted to us.
I mean, female bowerbirds, they spend hours like trotting about looking at all these male birds' bowers and making a decision about which one they're going to go and sit in. So they're obviously like checking out all the colours and the shapes and everything.
Well, I feel like saying one of these clever things that the lecturer is saying. This is something for your essay, Maria, isn't it? What's the difference between the bowerbird's experience and yours? Because there is a difference, right? Isn't there? Do you think the bowerbirds are talking about the clearing of the being of being?
No, of course not.
No, so you see, we bring something. But
are there
but,
species who?
But no, just can I just? This is crucial. The appreciation of the beauty of nature is something we bring, and the ornithologist guy. Was working. I think he's working under a certain probably Darwinistic understanding of things. Yes, we have world. Animals have an environment. Of course, we spent the whole lecture on how animals are sensitive to the triggers that their instincts are attuned to. And that's entirely different to our having a world and our being able to, in some sense, experience and appreciate the being of beings. This is the centre of Heidegger's philosophy. And it's our ability to experience the being of beings is our ability to know love and beauty. So it's not nothing.
Don't you think animals know love and beauty?
Well, I've my study of my schnauzer, or my mum's schnauzer, is not. It depends what you mean by love. But that, for me, love is a deep recognition of the being of another, and I don't think Herman had that for me. He had a certain kind of, you know, he liked being held, and, you know, he'd lick me, but I didn't think that was, that wasn't love for me.
You're two different things, John.
I think you could tune it down and say, you know, that he would, there was a certain, there's a certain frequency of love there. I mean, I certainly felt a kind of a loving thing for the little thing, you know? And I felt like he kind of had some kind of sense somewhere in him that was responding to that, but not. It's all. If the animals love, then we have another. There's another dimension to our love.
Are there each other species who gaze at the sunshine and marvel at it?
Well, it's very hard to know what's going on in another if they don't have language.
Yeah. It's also a point of the sun, it just gets aroused. People, animals enjoy the sun.
They enjoy the sun, but like, look at the sunshine and the sun rising.
They probably don't think about it, though, but I mean, it doesn't mean they don't appreciate it.
You would climb a mountain to see this rising of the sun. Who does that? Which species does that, other than the human?
See what we're talking about here, you know, we're back in that former lecture, which was all about trying to catch what it is that distinguishes our human being from an animal being, and not saying it's language, because it's behind language is this something that's why Heidegger did the whole thing, to try and say, so you get a kind of a flash. Oh yeah, we actually experience the being of other things, and that's it. And language comes out of that. But to just the sentence, we experience the being of other things, in a way, as a kind of a tautology. Unless you see it, it doesn't mean anything.
Do you think you'd have thought that Neanderthals were Dasein? Because there's a lot of evidence now they had art and language.
Well, I think Heidegger is a good phenomenologist, would say in German. I couldn't possibly say that, because I don't have one in front of me. Yeah, and it's not enough, I think, purely on the basis of the archaeological remains. You have to have the, in some sense, you have to have the consciousness of the other being now.
But we interbred with them, and some people have got an awful lot, relatively an awful lot of Neanderthal DNA.
Yeah, no, I can think of some people I've met who maybe have. You know, it's not necessarily the case that we human beings are present like that all the time. We can inhabit animal states of awareness. So it's a moving thing as well, isn't it? But I want to keep on, maybe just this one slide, and then we'll have a break, because I just want to read what Heidegger said, because I've been alluding to this, and I'm aware that not all of you will have read this. So a bit of what Heidegger says, I'll just read this. We call this openness that grants a possible letting appear and show, clearing. So his language is terribly important. He wants to wring everything he can out of these words, even though they were German. This translation is doing the best. It's the openness that grants. All right. So there's a granting. It's not. There's something going on here that he wants to say. It's granting you access. The clearing is granting you access. It's not your little subjective conscious realm. You're granted access, and it's letting things appear, because there's a clearing, and if there weren't a clearing, then nothing could appear. It's all right. You've got it's poetic, metaphorical, and yet pointing at the quality of how it is now. The forest clearing, Lichtung, is experienced in contrast to dense forest. Lichtung goes back to Lichten. Licht is the same word as light. But in this sense, it means to lighten something, to, like if you take the load off your shoulders, you lighten the load, to make it free and open, to make the forest free of trees at one place. So he wants to distinguish two meanings of lighten. You lighten the load, or you can lighten by enlightened by putting light in. And he first wants to say, what I mean by the clearing is the lightening, the opening, the clearing of space, not putting light in it. It's only once there's a space that the light can illuminate something. Without the space, the light can't penetrate. So there's two senses of light involved here, and he means more that the thinning is the lightening of the forest. It's the creating of an openness, of a potentiality, a possible letting appear. What is light in the sense of being free and open has nothing in common with the adjective light, which means bright. Still, light can stream into the clearing, into its openness, and let brightness play with darkness in it. But light never first creates the clearing. Rather, light presupposes it. However, the clearing, the open region, is not only free for brightness and darkness, but also for resonance and echo, for sound and the diminishing of sound. The clearing is the open region for everything that becomes present and absent, including the grief, Maria. Right, we should have a break, even though it's more of the same afterwards. This isn't it. Because I think the clearing is the kind of culmination of Heidegger for us. You know, if you never do any Heidegger again, it's a good spot to end.